You're listening to Section D, first broadcast on the 29th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, and a very warm welcome to Section D. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. On today's show, we focus on classic innovations, designers finding a way to balance heritage with the demands of the present and the future. We begin the show by sitting down for a chat with Polly Leonard, editor of textile magazine Selvage, to talk about all things woven.
Textiles are the most important material to the history of humanity.
Next, we head down under to take a look at how the Australian Christmas, seasonally out of step with its counterparts in the Northern Hemisphere, is coming of age.
We're outdoors most often for Christmas Day. Half the time we might be on the beach or, you know, sitting around the pool, and there's a whole other element to Christmas than just the traditional turkey and Christmas pudding indoors.
Then we talk to Guido Biondi, creative director of Italian jeans company Roy Rogers, about how he keeps the brand fresh by drawing on its history. Finally, we finish off with a visit to an inflatable refugee centre in Berlin.
According to everything I know, we are the first shelter for refugees that was built in an air-inflated structure. So it has never been done before.
All that coming up right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. The heritage of textiles is not only fundamental to design, but to the modern world itself. No one understands this better than Polly Leonard, founder of Selvage, a handsome magazine dedicated to textile materials. I visited her at the Selvage shop in London's Highgate neighbourhood to talk about how the past and future of textiles informs her work.
I'm Polly Leonard. I founded a magazine called Selvage 12 years ago. It has expanded into a larger business with lots of different elements since then.
And what is Selvage and indeed your business about? What do you do?
We celebrate the sensual and cerebral appreciation of textiles.
What is it that Selvage as a magazine and perhaps your business is saying that nobody else is?
This is where I sound like a bit of a lunatic. I think next to food, textiles are the most important material to the history of humanity. Just to expand on that a little bit, if you go right back to, you know, cavemen, it was the putting materials together in a kind of under-over way that is now the structure of weave that was the foundation of all architecture. There wasn't any international trade before the invention of the sail. The wealth of this country and many other countries of the world were built on the Industrial Revolution, which started with the industrialization of the textile industry.
And maybe aside from the boons to trade, in terms of perception and design and kind of the immediate experience of textiles, do you think that's also important to the development of humanity? Or if you want to put it in less kind of grandiose terms, maybe just the experience of individuals, how do you think that's important?
Yes. I mean, the first thing you do when you wake up in the morning is you put on your clothes, and how those feel on your body impacts how you react with the rest of the world all day. So textiles, you cannot escape textiles. You will probably remember what you wore on a particularly significant day in your history. You're walking on a carpet often, sitting on a sofa. You are completely surrounded by cloth from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep, and from the minute you're born till even after you're dead.
Let's talk about your magazine, Selvage. It's a print magazine. Why do you choose to continue to print a physical magazine when so many other print titles are struggling? You know, it's a very difficult environment in which for print flourishing.
In the 12 years that Selvage has existed, we have, for that entire time, had a digital alternative. It accounts for about 10% of our business. But even shipping magazines halfway around the world, which is hugely expensive and takes a considerable amount of time, our readers still want that physicality. Whether that got anything to do with the fact that the magazine is about textiles, and our readers are aware of their material surroundings, could have something to do with the success of the physical magazine. We pay particular attention to the quality of the paper. We have two different paper stocks in each issue. It's a square magazine, so the physical experience of it is quite an important part of the whole thing, rather than, if you look at it on a screen, you just don't get quite the same experience.
And talking about textiles and the textile market more generally, we're speaking at the end of 2015. Has this year been a good year for textiles, and why?
It has been a good year for textiles. There's a kind of flip back to the 1970s happening if you look at trends in retail. And what was particularly evident at that time and now again is the structure. So we're seeing very large, obvious knitting and crochet and weaving structures in textiles, but also in things like plastic. At the London Design Festival, there was a very large display of bags and pots made out of plastic, but representing a knitting structure.
And in terms of your awareness of the global marketplace, you mentioned that, you're very kind of tuned in to textiles around the world. What kind of different trends are there, different regional trends around the world? Do different people want different things in different places, or are there global trends which transcend different geographies?
Okay, what I'm seeing here in the UK is a real interest in the artisan, the provenance of pieces. I think we're getting a lot of artisans living what might have once been a rural existence, but in an urban setting. So if you look at East London, for instance, there are lots of people hand carving spoons and hand dyeing fabric and making quilts that you would have, 30 years ago seen, in rural Wales, but it's now right in the city. As far as design's concerned, in textiles, the most interesting area is the Netherlands. The Eindhoven Academy is where all of the best designers, in my opinion, are coming from at present. There's also something called the Textile Lab at the Textile Museum. It's a kind of government-funded facility for designers to develop new work. They have state-of-the-art machinery. They're doing lots of interesting things with yarn creation. But slightly more long-term, I think the Southern Hemisphere is where we'll be looking for the most innovative work, particularly in Brazil and Argentina. They have a slightly different appreciation of fibre and use it in a slightly more intuitive way than in Western Europe.
That was me talking to Polly Leonard, founder of the textile magazine Selvage. Sometimes classic themes need updating to stay relevant in new contexts. In Australia, designers are adapting traditional Christmas decorations and trimmings to better suit the 40-degree temperatures. Annie Hastwell brings us this report from South Australia.
It's hard to get away from Santa, snow and reindeers over Christmas, even when the sun is beating down and the temperature hitting the high 30s. But here in the baking heat of southern Australia, a new aesthetic is quietly taking hold.
Here we have an Australian wreath. I've really tried to capture the landscape in this one.
Floral designer Eliza Clark spent the weeks before Christmas collecting Australian flora for what's the latest thing to have hanging on your door through the season.
The colours are really soft, pale greens and light browns and terracotta tones.
The new look Australian wreath is just one sign of a change in how Australians do Christmas. And as retailer Amanda Swale explains, a lot of it's being led by the natural colours of the Australian bush.
I'm currently looking at that little table there, which has a whole lot of wattle sort of colours, which are incorporated back into pine cones. So you've got some Australian natives incorporated back into European blooms. It's very much Australian colours. So you've got the blue gum, sort of silvery grey of the blue gum working through it. It's really very pretty and works beautifully back to the silvers. And if you're going to do a table sort of predominantly silver greens, it works really well.
And what about trees? Trees have stayed in the mix, haven't they?
They have very much. There is some very traditional, and then there's also some really contemporary. Looking around, there are some twig trees
twig tree here behind you?
Yeah, in varying sizes. So there's some big trees, which are really just look like dead trees, but they work really well. Rachel, our visual creative director, has a big hand in the more contemporary decoration.
Rachel?
Yeah, so the twig trees, I feel, are a bit more of like a Scandi kind of approach. But I feel like because they are leafless, it is a little bit more like contemporary to Australia, and you can, yeah, fresh white with, you know, timber and this copper kind of element. Yeah, it's funny because I did a few tables with that more moody marble and, you know, pillar candles dripping down, but I feel like for me when I dress my table, it's all about actually vibrant colour and, yeah, an Australian kind of more fun focus, I guess.
In a nearby inner city shopping strip, I find Catherine Hunter's concept shop. There's not a Santa in sight, just cool blues and silvers and a surprisingly wide range of Christmas-themed homewares.
We're outdoors most often for Christmas Day. We might be sitting at a lovely outdoor table, and so we take into account all those other factors like the cushions on the chairs, the lanterns we might use, and even down to all the lovely outdoor summer entertaining. That sort of is a big component of our Christmas, which probably isn't occurring in the Northern Hemisphere.
It's almost about summer as much as it's about Christmas, really.
Absolutely. And I think that's what's lovely about Australia. I mean, coming to Australia and experiencing Christmas here, I mean, half the time we might be on the beach or, you know, sitting around the pool, and there's a whole other element to Christmas than just the traditional turkey and Christmas pudding indoors.
Event designer Anne Hartley's been in the business for over 40 years. She says she's seen a real shift in what clients want in terms of the look of a Christmas fit-out or party.
Definitely whites with silvers. Also, you're seeing a lot of fabric incorporated into Christmas, whether it be the ribbons. Hessian has been a very popular fabric and texture used, but now it's moving into once again a cool, soft white linen or muslin, and that's being incorporated, whether it's decorating around the pot that your Christmas tree is in, or even if you're wrapping your gifts. So moving into the lovely white, soft, light, cool colours of the whites and creams.
So that's all reacting to the climate, I imagine.
Climate, yes. We're just a little bit tired of having the hot turkey on a 43 degree day and watching things melt on the table, whether it be the red candles or Santa looking just too hot.
Christmas food design too in Australia is bending to the will of the climate. Celebrity chef Simon Bryant says the traditional red and green themed Christmas table just doesn't work here.
Our light's very different. The southern light's very different. As soon as you get off a plane and land back in Australia, it's one of the first things you notice. That tinge that we have, the yellowy-orangey tinge, you know, as opposed to that kind of spectrum of white and blue. But also seasonally, there's so much vibrant yellow of your cooked prawns, of your golden roasted stuff, and yellow becomes a real colour that works well on the white background, works well with the season. People don't even know they're doing it. If you do a plate that's so heavily white, green and red, it doesn't actually look right at this time of year.
Now, in your time as a chef, have you watched Christmas become more Australian?
I think we're a culture struggling for some identity. The climate and season will push it. The last 20 years, people have started to understand seasonal and local food. So that's a big driver. You know, a turkey's lovely for a tradition, but as a lot of Australians are secular, so we're unshackled with no tradition, so it could go anywhere, but I see it going as right now it's more casual, it's more colourful, plates are more colourful, and they're a lot less organised. There's a lot of slam food down in the middle and just take your time with it type eating. And we do have a little open house policy in Australia. It's not kind of like arrive at 12 for Christmas. So I think that's a beautiful bit of our culture, our disrespect for punctuality. Embrace it.
For Monocle in Adelaide, I'm Annie Hastwell.
That was Monocle contributor Annie Hastwell reporting from South Australia on how design is helping the Australian Christmas come of age. Still to come on Section D, we look at how an Italian jeans company with a long history stays fresh in the modern world and visit an inflatable refugee centre in Berlin.
We're raising the curtain on a brand new show here on Monocle 24 devoted to the best in cinema. Tune in every week to hear hear from filmmakers, critics, and luminaries of the genre as we shine a spotlight on everything from revivals and the restoration of vintage cuts to Hollywood's golden age and the role of the auteur.
I never think of architecture or cities or landscapes in cinema as merely being a kind of neutral backdrop to the action. They are the action themselves.
Hear feature-length interviews with the biggest names, roundtable discussions, special reports, and more as Monocle 24 delves into the rich history of the silver screen. The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, in association with MUBI, premiering Fridays at 20:00 London time, because life is too short for bad films.
Roy Rogers was the first brand to produce jeans in Italy, beginning in 1952. Since then, their rugged utilitarian design has become iconic, both within Italy and without. I caught up with the creative director Guido Biondi to discuss how he balances the brand's heritage with the need for development.
My grandfather started Roy Rogers in 1952. I mean, the brand was registered in 1952. And my grandfather started as a workwear clothing producer, and during the 60s and the 70s, the denim became fashion items. So Roy Rogers is the first denim producer in Italy, and we still doing denim in Italy, and we make a lot of attention in terms of quality and research of denim. In fact, we provide our denim, most of them from Kone Denim, because when my grandfather start with Kone Denim, the famous denim producer in North Carolina, and we continue our collaboration over 60 years.
And Guido, how have you and the company worked to keep the brand relevant over such a long period?
Our benchmark is our archive. So we always keep attention of our archive, so stitching details in general, the fabrics. We continue to use the old sewing machine that my grandfather used at the time, so we keep our vintage in every single stitch. We like to keep our vintage face of the brand, but we also like to present ourselves with a kind of a modern twist. For example, the capsule collection with Scott Schumann from Sartorialist.
Tell me a little bit more about that, because, you know, it's just one of the collaborations that you've engaged with to keep the brand dynamic and developing. But yeah, this is obviously a special one. How did you get to know Scott, and what's he done with you?
So Scott, it's thanks to his work about shooting tons of cool people around the world. He know about the trends and the atmosphere around fashion. So we choose him because he can give us important trends, especially in the men's world. What we did this season for this capsule. So the capsule is the inspiration come from the 70s. So we also take a look, as I said before, about our archive. And the ideas behind of this collection is kind of changing the silhouette of the man. So now, and also in the last season, we saw a lot of men like with a short pants, very tiny jackets. What Scott suggests us is to give a little bit more fit of the jeans, so the proportion became more longer, and the pants, the waist of the pants became more higher. So the shirts will be inside of the pants, the color of the shirts will be more 70s, and it's the kind of what I explained before about our brand is like a vintage inspiration but with a modern twist.
And Guido, am I right in thinking that that's going to be unveiled at the next Pitiomo?
Yes, we will make a presentation at the second days at Pitti, and Scott will explain all the collection, and explain all the fabrics, all the ideas of this capsule.
Fantastic. And finally, Guido, where are the growth markets for Roy Rogers? Where are they in the world, and who are they? And how do you plan to expand into them?
Yeah, our biggest market is still Italy, but we are working a lot to grow in internationally. The Japan is doing very good. So we are going to open another big corner in Tokyo. We have opened last year in Osaka, and it's doing very good. So we are opening in February the second corner in Tokyo, inside Hankyu, the big department store in Tokyo. And we're inside Holland. We are inside all Europe. So we are doing very hard to let the people know the brand Roy Rogers.
That was me talking to Guido Biondi, creative director of Italian jeans brand Roy Rogers. We're going to end today's show on a different note by heading to Berlin to check in on a design innovation improving the lives of some of Europe's most vulnerable residents. As the continent's worst refugee crisis since the Second World War continues, more than 340,000 asylum seekers are expected to have entered Germany by the end of 2015. And as their numbers increase, cities like Berlin are faced with the challenge of housing those going through the often drawn-out asylum application process during the cold winter. But a unique design solution has been popping up around the country. Monocle contributor Hayley Joelle Ott brings us this report from the capital.
It's a quiet winter morning as I make my way to the refugee center of the Berlin City Mission. I'm walking through your average park until I turn a corner and see a sports field, and on top of it, a big bubble. This is one of the first inflatable structures used in Germany to house refugees who are arriving in large numbers from places like Syria. I'm meeting Matthias Hoffmann, who manages the center.
Let's go. Okay, so this is the emergency shelter for refugees of the Berlin City Mission. What you see here is like the entrance area where we receive our guests. Here they get linen and towels from our volunteers. Usually they are registered there at our security and in our system, and then they are brought into the sleeping cabins. There are many people there, and we are like packed. We are full. So if you want to know where our guests are from, this is what you can see. So they are from Syria, they are from Afghanistan, they are from Kosovo, they are from Albania, Pakistan, and Iraq. So everything you read in German media about that, they are the people are from. So what you can also see is like they have their different factions here. So this is the flag of the Free Syrian Army, and this is the flag of the current Syrian state. So that is like we have the different people here.
And these are child's drawings?
No, not necessarily. So everyone. So we have a lot of drawings, drawing sessions here, and that's why these can be also adult paintings.
And so, can you tell us a bit about?
This is a so-called air-inflated structure. If you look it up at Wikipedia, you realize that the technique is quite old. It's been around since 60, 70 years. So it works basically like this. You have a hall with where you have inside a little bit upper pressure. So and the pressure difference between inside and outside is not so big. So it's as if you went from the first floor of a building into the fourth floor of a building. This is the pressure difference. But this pressure difference is enough to carry the 6.5 tons of steel ropes you have around here. So, yeah, this is basically the function. So, according to everything I know, we are the first shelter for refugees that was built in an air-inflated structure. So it has never been done before. So we opened up a year ago, and within a year, more than 30 shelters like this opened up all over Germany.
Do you think that this sort of structure might be a solution for refugees in other areas of Europe where it's becoming cold outside?
We have been here last winter, and we are here this winter. So, and as you realize, okay, there's a heating, so that means you can... make it warm and cozy, but of course it costs a lot of energy. This is the trade-off you have, because it's quite kind of flexible.
You said you were full at the moment.
Yes.
Is it full every day? How long do people stay here?
So the initial plan was that they stay only here one until 3 days. At the moment, people are staying here, at least some people are staying here till May.
Till May. And then, and what are people when they leave, where are they going?
So as you might have seen that Berlin has a very big problem in its administration regarding refugees. So the registration and the administration is broken down. So I cannot say what happens to the people afterwards. A lot of our guests are sent back to us because there are no other shelters. So for instance, this morning there was a report in the news that in the administration, the registration center, there are no electronic files. So for instance, they have a lot of files that are not processed till the end. So they are laying around and nobody knows where they are. So this, the result is also seen here. The normal process is you arrive in, as a refugee in Germany, and you say, wow, I want to be request asylum, and then you're registered and you're given a shelter and why, and then later on you are distributed among the different federal states in Germany, and afterwards you stay in a shelter for 3 to 6 months, and during that time you have your application for asylum. So, and when this is done, you have your interview, and then you wait until you're finished. So, and this is the normal process. But in Berlin, a lot of the first steps do not happen properly.
Do you feel overwhelmed?
No, the administration is overwhelmed, and this is not because of the number of refugees, but because it's Berlin, so a city which cannot manage to finish its airport in a proper time. No wonder that this is happening too. And we do not have to forget that in other parts of Germany there are a lot of refugees coming too, but they are at least able to process them as it should be done.
That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Toby Hammond. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to drop me a note at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. And of course, you can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Until next time, it's goodbye from me,